Hey everyone, we are back with part two of our interview with Jay. If you have not checked out the main portion of the interview, I would encourage you to go ahead and check that out first before diving in here. But if you don't want to take my advice, or if you've already listened to the episode, I hope that you enjoy this episode as well. And I know that we had a lot of fun with it, so I'm going to stop talking now and we'll get back into it. Awesome. All right, Ian, anything else before we wrap up?
No.
You can shoot away. Ask me all the questions you want. I'm here.
Highlight
of my day.
My mind is still on the whole on the Adobe thing and Ted Osbach. So, you know, it's all right.
I'm so intimidated to ask Ted questions about Adobe Illustrator.
Does he know that you betrayed Adobe for Final Cut?
Yeah, he knows.
Oh,
yeah.
Like,
but I have Adobe Suite and I have
has his foot in there just in case.
But it's always that line of like, will he answer me? Like, he's like, yeah, sure. That's a good question. Yeah. You do this. Or you could do the shortcut and make it faster. I'm like, oh, okay. Or is it going to be like, seriously, you don't know how to do this? So it's, yeah. So it's that delicate dance that I do.
I get it. I mean, I was kind of intimidated to go up to Ted Osbach when we saw him at the convention. I was like, they were like, you should go do it. And I was like, I don't know. I don't want to be a fanboy. But I mean, he has that kind of intimidating presence about him, right? Where he's very tall and towers over you.
Dude is tall. Yeah, he is. Man. He's tall. Man. He's one of the tallest in the industry, I think.
That sounds right.
Yeah. I mean, he's one of the tallest in the world, it feels like to me. So, I mean,
I believe Stefan Feld is taller. I believe.
Okay. I haven't seen him in person.
Taller. I haven't either, but I've heard Stefan Feld is tall. I've heard Ignacy's tall. The doctor is supposed to be pretty tall.
Okay. I think Ted Osbach is bigger than Ignacy.
I think so too. I believe I was told that as well. They're like, Ignacy. I think I mentioned that to Ted. He's like, that midget?
No,
Ignacy's not that tall. But yeah, Sevenfeld's supposed to be pretty tall from what I hear.
Okay. Do you, Jay, so you're our first interviewee. I'm curious. Do you ever ask the interviewer any questions? Do you ever turn it on its head?
Well, when I interview people, I always ask them, what questions should I have asked? What questions do you wish someone would ask you?
Yeah.
That's something I would usually ask people. I don't have an answer for that, but... But I mean, most people talk to me about Cardboard East, about Games from Asia, about Bezier Games. I did a recent written interview about being an Asian American Pacific Islander. Mm. Anna Guerra, what does that mean to me?
Yeah.
I don't have any questions off the top of my head, but I love answering questions. I was single for a long time, did a lot of dating, so you just get used to it after that. you find the game, I guess.
Yeah. No, that's cool. One other thought I had. So with you doing Cardboard East and working with Bezier, is there a world where in the future you're doing more, I don't know how that would even look, but is there a world where Bezier moves into YouTube in some capacity? Have y'all talked about stuff like that?
That is something that I have thought about by creating more of that. I think right now it's just the first year. I just want to be able, like, can I just keep the boat afloat?
Yeah. Can I do my job right?
Can I stay at inbox zero? Is that something I can achieve every day?
Right.
It's not, but I'm getting there. It's I usually get to inbox zero like once a week.
Oh, that's good.
It's hard. It's a battle.
I can imagine.
So I'm just doing that because it's a small company, so we all wear a lot of hats.
Yeah.
But marketing is a lot. So not only do I think I could say marketing, but what does that mean exactly? It's just like I run, I'm also the social media manager. So I run all the socials, all the posts, everything. I have to create the content for those posts. And if I don't create the content, I need to find it somewhere else or steal like an artist and take someone else's content, play with it, make something else and new. I have to... I also help with the editing for the rule books and the copy for the rule books. I talk to all the influencers and make sure we get the review copies out to people. So I'm the point of contact for all of them, which has been interesting for me as a content creator because I have to find out everyone's pricing. So I'm like, oh, okay. These are the prices. And so I have an idea now of what like a review should cost, a playthrough should cost, and like a Twitch stream it costs. So there's, and then like, I don't know, there's so much. Oh, and then like getting ads and like reviews for like the print shows and like running the Amazon page and running all the Amazon pages to make sure everything's there.
Right.
Like there's
a lot.
There's a lot. Like if it were a bigger company, that would be like several jobs.
Right. Yes. Yeah. That yes. would be a many, many, many people's jobs.
But it's just me. So and then like, you know, going to conventions and creating content at conventions and like treating people at conventions. So there's a lot to the job. So I don't want to branch out too much my first year and just try to, you know, keep the bar low so that way I blow their mind year two.
Ah, there it is.
Right. We're getting comfortable in the role.
Yeah, but to let you, it is something that I have been thinking about, like, and what would that look like? And right now I'm kind of fooling around with the TikTok and just having fun with the TikTok, just kind of making like tons of fun little stuff.
Sure.
For that and not taking it too seriously because it's TikTok. Right.
Do you find, I'm curious about this because you kind of dipped into our quote unquote industry for a little bit there. Do you find that prices with reviews and interviews and things like, well, I guess not interviews, but reviews, doing TikToks or videos or full on like unboxings, are those prices pretty consistent across the board with the various artists or is it pretty scattered?
Jared, it is the Wild West.
I imagine so.
It is the Wild West. Back like a year or two ago when Quackalope had that big hullabaloo, right? Where he got caught like telling a publisher, well, I'll make a positive video if you pay me like $8,000.
Yes, the funnest time.
And it's so funny because as a content creator, I saw how people were reacting. And like a lot of gamers like were reacting of like, this is just, you know, this is so untrustworthy. Yeah. This is so duplicitous. This is, how can you trust anything he says? And then a lot of content creators were like, $8,000? What?
Yeah.
Well, how much was he charging?
Yeah.
You know, so like it's wild, man. And like, not every publisher can afford to pay that.
Right.
Sure. But
certain publishers can.
Yeah.
And knowing which ones can, which ones to pitch to, like it's really difficult. Like the publishers that I deal with, like from Cardboard East, like they're all tiny.
Yeah.
A lot of them are like 1, 2, 3 people teams. Mm-hmm. Like they can't afford $8,000. Right. And, you know, for like a Kickstarter preview, that's brutal. Right. Yeah. So, but you know, it's, and it's a thing. Cause like, you're not really, and like, I see that all the time too. Like with, so it's a Wild West. Like the prices vary all the time. One of the things that really grinds my gears is that when people talk about how publishers rely on tutorial videos instead of writing a good rule book.
Yeah.
And I hear people say that a lot. I'm like, and I'll say that as a marketing manager, the number one reason why I ask someone or I ask like Rodney or Before You Play, like to do a tutorial video is marketing.
Yep.
It's not because the rule book is crappy. It's because marketing and paying for more people to see it. And tutorial videos are, I think, the best content because I think they're better than reviews because tutorials are evergreen and are watched all the time.
Yeah.
And so by doing that, like it creates good content for that person. It gets content for me as a publisher and it's great marketing. So I use tutorial videos as marketing. And the truth is that I know that you don't like crappy rule books. I don't like them either. But a lot of people don't read rule books.
Right. Yeah.
And a lot of the times when people complain about a rule book, it's like, well, did you read it thoroughly?
There you go.
Every page?
Yep.
Well, you know, and it's fine. That's really easy to skip over a rule when you're reading the rule books. And that rule could just appear once. And people are like, well, why didn't you repeat it, you know, 20 times? I'm like, well, because you wouldn't pick up the rule book if it was, you know, 100 pages.
That's fair. That's fair.
Well, and it's interesting too, right? Because for a lot of people, I mean, granted, there are crappy rule books out there.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people, yes, when they're saying the rule book sucks, it's more about being able to skim the rule book to grab a rule quickly than it is the rule book as a whole.
Right.
Like I want to, in the middle of a game, I want to be able to find something to be able to answer the question and get back to the game.
Yeah.
So for me, that's usually where I'm like, man, I don't know about this rule book. I mean, I get it. I would never want to write a rule book.
It's hard. It's hard. And there are people who specialize it, and I think they do a really good job.
Do. Yeah. They do.
I love the Fantasy Flight dual rule book approach of like having like a quick, easy to learn rule book, and then having another rule book that's an FAQ.
Yep.
And then like, because like
with an index and it's perfect. Oh, it's perfect.
With an index.
Yes.
And it's all done like indices. It's not about how to play. It's just like, this is it. Yep. Like one of my favorite games. I think the best dungeon crawler on the planet right now is not Gloomhaven or Frosthaven. It's Arkham Horror, the card game.
Okay.
And that rule book is just amazing because it's indexed and you want to look up this one term. You look at the index. There it is. You flip to that page. There's your answer. Yep. Super, super clear. Gloomhaven's not like that.
No, no, it's not. Yeah.
It's not. And like as cool as rulebooks are, like I like PDFs sometimes even more because I can just control F that.
Right.
And
exactly.
Find the word I'm looking for.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are, I love, and I do think Fantasy Flight does that because, you know, I mentioned earlier, like Marvel Champions is one of my favorite games. So they do have an index, same thing, little rulebook and then the index. Yes. The PDF that's updated frequently because the rule book when the first game first came out, same thing with Arkham, like there's just so many more, there's so much more content than when the game came out. So like to be able to just have a PDF with updated content and updated rules, it's genius. It's so helpful. So helpful.
Yep. That's really useful for card games.
Yes. Yes. For games that are constantly living card games, games growing, that are constantly developing. Yes. Incredibly helpful.
I learned a few years ago that living card game isn't a thing.
Oh.
It's a term for Fantasy Flight. So there are no living card games except for Fantasy Flight. I mean, they have that model.
Right. It's their, it's their Dominion model. And I love it.
But there are no living card games. Anyway, that's one of those weird things you don't
It's fascinating.
That's,
think about.
Okay, so that's interesting. So what, I mean, I've never thought about this till right now, but I'm thinking about like Sentinels of the Multiverse that does a similar thing where it's got a core box and then it comes in, it spits out a bunch of expansions and that sort of thing. So does Fantasy Flight like have a copyright on that title of living card game?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay.
Wild.
I mean, a copyright and a trademark don't mean anything.
Sure.
unless you don't defend it.
Right.
Okay.
You know, if you don't defend it, it doesn't mean anything. Like Disney will come after you. Wizards of the Coast will say you have to rotate cards 90 degrees. You cannot tap them.
That's right.
Right. Right.
I think that's, and most of the time the board game industry is pretty chill about that. Like they're like, oh, I'm creating a game about spiders and a deck builder. Oh, Jared, you're already doing that? Well, I won't do that anymore.
Right.
I'll retheme my game to do something else. And the industry on the whole, for the most part, is pretty cool about that.
And even stuff that's like kind of, that takes aspects of other games, you see it happen a lot where something it's like, oh, I've seen literally this exact mechanic. And it's just, it's part of a game. It's not the game like it was before in a different game. And it's like, I mean, that seems like it's well accepted because it happens frequently. And it's not like I'm like, oh yeah, like this game's just way better. No, like they each have their own things. And I think it's awesome that you're taking ideas from other people, just not obviously not copying the same exact game, but.
Yeah. Yeah, there's I think I had an argument with someone, or an argument, a debate with someone a while ago where I talked about that. Bang is the most influential board game of all time, is what I said.
Okay.
And they're like, I don't, that's just ridiculous. And I'm like, no, it is. And I said, the reason why is because Bang goes really big. And then in China, someone liked it and they rethemed it with the Three Kingdoms retheme.
Okay.
And they call it Sangwo Sha, or like Three Kingdom Murder, I believe. And though it's the exact same mechanics, but just in the Three Kingdom universe. Okay. And that it sold like wildfire, and it did so well that the publisher was like, hey, let's bring this to the States. And they brought it to the States. And then Bang was like, dude, that's our game. That's our exact game.
Right.
Lawsuit happened, okay, and Bang lost.
Wow.
Huh.
And it's a good thing that Bang lost because that meant that game mechanics are not, you can't copyright.
Can't copyright them.
You can, but it's extremely expensive.
Yeah.
To the point where no publisher would ever do that.
Right.
Unless like, you know, Apple or Disney wanted to start making board games for some weird reason.
Huh.
And so, and that's a good thing because then like all the deck builders on the planet would be owned by Rio Grande.
Right. Yeah.
Right. That no one wants yeah. that.
No,
you know?
No,
yeah. No. All the bag buildings would be like by Capstone Games. Right. I think Orleans was the first one.
Yeah.
Right. So like,
yeah.
And it would just severely limit everything. Yeah. That was what it would severely limit the creative space and the design between each game, because there are games that are similar, but like they're different. And I like games that are similar in some ways, but like, there's a reason why I like both of these. Like, both of these are good for this reason.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's a good point.
Do you think that as the hobby continues to grow, like right now it's this like niche, really close group, you know, of publishers and designers and everything like that, that works together. Do you think that enough of a foundation is there that will continue as it grows, or as bigger players? I mean, Apple is a crazy example, but like, you know, going off of that, if Apple were to come in and become part of this market, Apple's not going to play well with Bezier Games or whoever.
No, it's not.
Do you foresee that the hobby continuing in this play nice, or is there they're going to come a point where it outgrows itself?
I really hope not. I really think that it'll continue to play nice. And I think the reason why it's going to play nice is because gamers will force publishers to play nice.
Mm, okay. Mm. That makes sense.
Because they do a really good job of that on BGG. So I think, like, you know, there's a good and bad side to Twitter. There's a good and bad side to Reddit.
Yep.
You know, everyone has an opinion, but not every opinion is worth listening to. Yeah.
That's true.
But it's good that that it's there and people can keep check with each other.
Yeah.
And I think that the board game industry will continue to be cool. I do think it's growing. I mean, it's 12 billion and growing.
Wow.
Like, it's huge. And like, at the leave, like, I read some marketing pamphlet that's like, that said like, in 2019, that like every minute a game was sold in France.
Whoa. That's crazy.
You know, it's just like, it's, and that's just France. That's just the second biggest market.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the planet.
That's crazy.
So it's going to be huge. I think the biggest impact I think that's going to happen, that's happening now, and that publishers are dealing with, is just the logistics is just really expensive right now.
Yeah.
And I say right now, but the truth is that it's going to continue to go up. Because once something goes up in price, it rarely
goes back down.
It's just why would it? You know, until the demand goes away.
Demand goes away, but wages, you got to pay for wages. Wages go up. So it's now that games are more expensive. And then it's hard because games are getting more expensive to ship, Kickstarters and crowdfunders have a rougher time. And people are always complaining. It's like, it's just too much to ship. And like, established publishers shouldn't be on Kickstarter. I'm like, well, then you don't get Castles of Burgundy special edition.
Right.
No publisher would create a deluxe edition and go straight to retail with it.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, it is crowdfunded for a reason, because it's extremely risky. It's extremely expensive.
Yeah.
And every publisher that I know subsidizes shipping costs.
Yeah.
They eat the cost of the shipping. For most, like every publisher, at least that I've talked to, one I know pays to have the backers pay for everything.
Right.
Also because because like, you don't know what the shipping costs are going to be 6 months from now.
Right.
You know, like,
yeah, sure.
Like, yeah, the publisher might make money off of the shipping fees that they're charging you, but they're not going to make a lot, not enough to stay afloat. And it's more of a cushion because like, oh, it's, you know, $100 today. What if it's $10,000, you know, next year, my company goes out of business.
Oh, yeah. I have an experience with this whole thing.
Oh gosh, this is Ian's scar for life. Go ahead, have your little crying moment.
I love it.
I don't know if the listeners hear this again.
You gotta move the spotlight. I'm gonna move that spotlight.
Go ahead, tell Jay your tale of woe.
This is the worst Kickstarter experience of my life that I'm about to share.
Jared immediately picks up his phone. I've heard this, so straight to phone mode.
Jay, I have told him from the get go, don't do this, and he did it anyways. And now he's still sad about it.
You gotta get him a shirt.
Hold on a second. When I first backed it, you didn't say not to do it.
I,
No, I told you not to.
No, you didn't. You liar.
I did.
Wait, did you back like a mythic game or something?
Oh, he knows too.
He already knows.
I just guessed. I totally guessed.
I backed Rainbow Six or R6 Siege, whatever it was. And it was after COVID. It was like 2021 is when it was later COVID, but they dropped the Kickstarter. And so pledged some money, whatever. Campaign ended, I think early 2022, probably. Well, they took my money and ran because I didn't hear from them again, and nobody did. And you're talking about, I can't remember how many backers I'd have to look, but it was so many. And a year later, they come back and say, like you're saying, basically, we have no money. And they asked for, I did like a very minimal pledge. I dropped 130 or something, minimal pledge. I got like a couple.
That's a minimal pledge, everybody.
I know. Yeah, that is a minimal pledge on Kickstarter.
He wanted to go way higher.
I did. It was, the all in was 350, I think. And I know a lot of people did that. But after the year of silence, they asked for basically another 120 because to minimize the damages, asked for another 120. Then to pay for shipping again, I've already paid for shipping. They asked for shipping a second time. So I had to basically pledge double of what my original was. And I was like, no, I'm not doing this. On top of that, they asked, basically they said that because of, you know, the process and everything, you can ask for a refund and we'll put you in the queue for that. Well, you know, thousands of people are putting in their queue for the refund. So I have sent multiple emails, including thousands of other people. And they answer with a generic email that says, you are this blank ticket number. And so I have not received my refund, nor will I ever.
Ever.
And and everybody just got their game I think last month. So the Kickstarter started in 2021. And they just now received their pledge in 2024 after a 3-year process of asking for more money, and people did pay it. I think the number was on a full pledge was after tax and shipping and everything, it would have been $1,000 that you paid for the all in pledge. And I lost $150, whatever, but I'm not salty about it whatsoever. But
yes, you are.
No, not. I'm thirsty. There's so much salt in my mouth. I will say, Ian, though, that, and I'll say this, and I know I sound like I sound horrible when I say this, but at the bottom of every Kickstarter page is a section called Risks and Challenges.
I know. I've read it.
So, but you know, I'm a little bit jaded myself because like the very first Kickstarter that I backed was Glory to Rome.
Ooh.
And that Glory to Rome Black Box Edition took years to fulfill. And the dude lost his house. I mean, like, I eventually got my copy. And ever since then, I'm like,
this is worth somebody's house.
This is the norm. Like, it takes years for me to get it. Yeah. Oh, I got it in 6 months. That's great.
Yep.
I back it. Oh, I get it later. Oh yeah, I back this. I totally forgot about that. That's great. Yeah. I have a great surprise for me.
That's usually what I do. Like, I mean, I usually very much like look through the process. I generally look through Mythic, but I did not investigate. Then this is where they got me. I did not investigate as much because of the theme, because I'm a big Rainbow Six player.
I am too.
And so that one got me. And so that's what happens when you just don't do your research. So unfortunately, but I don't.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword because like stuff like that has happened and it will continue to happen. Yeah, but at the same time, like, without crowdfunding, you're not going to get like those amazing Lacerda games.
Yeah. Well,
with this
and
super high quality production.
So one of my favorite games. It's funny because my like the worst experience ever has the opposite of that is one of the best experiences, because one of my favorite games is Batman Gotham City Chronicles, and that game is insane and one of my favorites. I've painted a lot of the minis.
The production
of
that.
Yeah, so it's
phenomenal.
It is a double-edged sword. It's unfortunate, but that's just how it goes.
But I also think that it's overall good for the hobby. I know like a lot of people have angry thoughts about crowdfunding, but I love it.
I'm all in.
The one thing I'm interested in is about it is that it it has forced publishers to make pretty games.
Yeah. No, it has.
It has forced every publisher on the planet to up their game and pay for art.
Yeah.
And like, art is very expensive. Yeah. It's extremely expensive. And it's, but it sells games. And I would say, as a reviewer of board games and as someone who works for Bezier Games, I will say that art will sell a game faster than mechanics in 2020s.
Yeah.
Right.
Because like you can't see those mechanics across the room.
Yeah.
And like
and I can see the box on the shelf. So
Flamecraft, I think Flamecraft is a good game. I do think it's wildly mediocre, but it sells because
it's cute.
It was marketed well. Yeah. It is super cute. It has fantastic arts. The assets are amazing to look at. Yeah. And it sold and it brought a ton of people into the hobby, which is ultimately a good thing.
Yeah. No, for sure.
Well, and it's interesting, right? Because in that vein, we have come across several games that we'll even see on BGG are very highly rated. And then we'll play it and we're like, people only like this for the art. Like there's this is a half-baked game or it's whatever. I'm thinking about like Sea Salt and Paper.
Yeah.
I played that and I was like, this is just rummy with cute paper cards on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I get it, man. Like, you know, like my cousin, when he was a kid, he loved the Transformers movie. I'm like, dude, really? It wasn't that great of a movie, man.
Easy.
Like,
oh, it's easy.
It spoke to me. I was like, okay, maybe you really like those Megan Fox scenes. Yeah. I don't know. But it's, I think that's what makes me love Asian board games the most, more and more as the years go by. And it's why like my passion for cardboard ESIC grows stronger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And especially as a gamer who really began to flourish a little bit more in the aughts. Was it games in the aughts all and board games from Asia today have similar feels where it's they strip the game down to so that it's very simple and approachable, but there's a lot of depth and layers to the game. Like you don't need a lot of extra chrome. Can you make a game that's really fun without all that extra chrome?
Yeah.
And the people are finding ways to do it and still do it. And I think that's why like some of those classics from years gone by like are still around or still talking. Like people still play Carcassonne. I think Carcassonne is a fantastic game. Mm. You know, people still play El Grande. There's a new edition of El Grande, right?
Yeah.
And it's because it's that good of a game. And then people will say like, well, you know, Jay, I Roots is better than El Grande. Or they'll say that, you know, Inish is better than El Grande. And I'll say that, okay, that's true. I would say that both of those games are probably better than El Grande. But the amount of fun you have in El Grande and the amount of fun you have playing Root, is it that much different?
Right. Yeah.
And then think about how much bang for your buck you get with El Grande.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that like that's something I always ask people about that. They're like, oh yeah, you know, like Nana is, I had so much fun playing Nana and Trio, but like it's just a deck of cards.
Right. Yeah.
You know, can you have a game that does that? Like I think to me that's really fascinating because that's an artwork that's you really have to be on top of your game to come up with a game like that.
And that just I feel like that encapsulates that whole saying that you said just is the memory in the experience, and is that game providing a memory that's lasting more than just the gameplay? Because if a game is doing that, if a game is providing this experience in good ways and leaving a lasting memory, then it's doing its job. No matter what that art is, how old that game is, how long it's been on your shelf, in the end, when you sit down with your friend group at the table and you sit down and play this game, is there an experience being created there and a memory? And if there is, then it's a great game. So and there's so many great games out there. That's what you aim to do. It's what you aim to design. It's what you aim to buy as a consumer. And that's the ultimate goal.
Yeah. I used to say that there are a lot of crappy games out there, but and there are more of them, but I would say that, I know Tom Basso has gotten salty too. I mean, who wouldn't after a decade of playing as many games as he does, but
yes.
I think that, most of the time when I play games now, I don't think it's bad. I think to myself, like, this is an underdeveloped game.
Yeah.
Or an overdeveloped game. I think like this game could have been developed more and find something special. Yeah. And then I ask myself as a designer slash publisher, like, is the gimmick worth all the development that went into it?
Yeah.
Could this just have been a simpler game? Just call it a day. So usually I find that I think like, oh, this game could have needed more development, or I think this game wasn't worth the development, and therefore I'd say it's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where I usually fall. Like, I mean, is there really a difference between rating a game 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on BGG?
I mean, no, that's fair.
Seriously,
for sure.
Other than spite, is that it? Right. Your level of spite that you have?
That's it. That's what it is. People need to be able to vent.
Yep.
So, but I do like, and I'll kind of wrap with this. I do in a way, yes, we could all say that Tom Vassell is jaded because he's played 10,000 games and you're kind of losing your mind at that point. But I think the hobby as a whole has kind of learned to look at games differently. And it's not so much just we're excited to have a game now. Our tastes have evolved beyond cereal. Yeah. Like I want this game to taste like a steak now. And so, you know, it's great to have a bowl of cereal, but I'd rather have a steak.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But I mean, that's not to say that, you know, someone who's new to cereal is going to have cereal and be like, Cookie Crisp is the bomb. What are you talking about?
No, I get it.
It is. And I get it. I mean, I'm more of an oatmeal, banana, and granola kind of guy these days. But, you know, Cookie Crisp and Honeycomb were, you know, my jam back in the day.
That's right.
I get it. Yeah. But your tastes evolve, right? And so it's cool that those of us that are in it are asking and pushing publishers and designers to be more. So I like that. And it creates growth. So yeah,
I just wish that more designers taste the fun as opposed to the mechanic.
Right.
There's almost like, it almost feels like there's this fear of not creating that fairness, that mitigating as much luck as possible, especially here in the States on the West side.
I tell people all the time when I go to conventions and talk to me, I'm like, no, balance is for wussies.
Yeah.
I love
it. Let that game be imbalanced. Let the players have that metagame and figure it out. Like that's where I fall.
Yeah. No, I can totally get behind that, especially like you said, if it's creating fun along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what it is. And like when you look at the game, it's kind of like a friend, right? You hang out with that friend, 5, 10, 20, 50 times, and you have memories of that friend and it's going to stick with you forever. And I think that's why we all, love this hobby so much and cherish it and talk about it and want it to grow and prosper. And, you know, hopefully more mature people, play the game.
That's right.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Jay, one more time, let everybody know, since we're coming up on 2 hours, they might've forgotten at this point. Let everybody know, where they can find you and we'll go from there.
Sure. I am at, everywhere, at Cardboard East. So that's my handle for me. So I'm on Twitter or the platform formerly known as Twitter, now known as X, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, especially. So go like, subscribe every single video and have all your relatives do that as well.
Nice.
And I'm also at Bezier Games everywhere else. So if you see something there, follow, like, and subscribe to everything Bezier Games and you'll make my day.
Awesome.
But most importantly, just have fun with the games you have.
That's right.
Nice.
But buy all the Bezier Games.
Shameless. I love it. Well, listeners, thank you so much for listening. If you have feedback on anything that we've talked about or want to give us your thoughts on the games that you've heard about today, please either hit up us or Jay. Links to our socials are in the description of the episode. If you don't like socials, I get it. I don't either, but there's other ways. So please feel free to shoot us an email at thegametablepodcast@gmail.com or head over to our website at thegametablepodcast.com or find us on BoardGameGeek. 5-star reviews, subscribing to your podcast player of choice, following us on socials, and joining the conversation on Discord. All of these heroic actions are immensely helpful in growing this podcast. Special thanks to Angie Santiago for our cover art and to Anna Snyder who made the music. Join us next week as Anna and I dive back into a game in the two top table. In the meantime, may your dice rolls and your card draws be blessed, and your experiences at the table be ones to remember forever.
Beautiful, man. That's beautiful.
Thanks, dude. I worked really hard on it. I wanted a good sign off and everyone had all the like the good quirky like quick ones. So I was like, I'm just going to make something up here. So I worked on it for a while.
That's right.